Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome to the latest episode of the El Arpa podcast. After an unscheduled 2-week hiatus after coming back from Christmas, I guess we're struggling to shake off those post-Christmas blues. Could only manage one podcast, took last week off, and here we are again just before February. We got to up our game, Mary.
Yay, I think it's a great month.
Okay, well, I like the pep in your voice for that. Well, January has been quite nice. Very, very cold, as is its wont in Madrid. There's a terrible ill wind that blows for 3 months of the year. What's this saying? 9 months of hell and 3 months of...
As you put it, you put it, no?
Yeah, I don't know. Something about the weather. Anyway, moving on. We saw the most beautiful sky tonight, and super red. And last night was a super moon. So I think you're really enjoying the seasons of the year so far.
Really enjoying it because I'm a little bit simple. Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yes. Well, you know, I'm always enthusiastic about nature.
Well, no, I mean, seasons are very important to us, and even though we are in an urban setting, I don't think we're removed from the effects of the seasons on our soul and our psyche. I remember last year we were speaking about how this stretch of the year can seem interminable sometimes, mm-hmm. compared to the early rush before Christmas, and then from San Isidro in May to the summer stretching out after that. Those two parts of the year have a lot going on for them, but that January, yeah. February, March can be quite difficult. It just seems very blah, very kind of like without focus and without interest or anything with anima or a state of being or happiness, you know. So, but with the light that we've been having, it's given it a luster that it doesn't normally have, and has made January a bit more bearable, I think.
Definitely. Well, yeah. I think light is one of the things that it's contributed to it. But I think it's also a matter, like we said before, that the year is structured.
Artificially.
Yes, and then...
It's a capitalist artifice.
Well, I don't know if I would go that far. But yeah, it's just you need some sort of marker, I don't know, the year, and then it's useful sometimes to, I don't know, to do things that have a certain limit or that mark somehow what makes these months special. And, well, we're doing some of these things. We have our Hini month.
Oh, yes.
For example.
Exactly, yeah. Only one more week of that. Mm-hmm. You've had some success with, you have the success with all the photographs. You're a great Twitter machine. But if you have really. If you have stood out as being the most popular, what have they been out of interest?
The Bog Bodies. It's a series that of poems that Heaney wrote about, Bog Bodies, or like bodies that were mummified by the bog, basically. And it's quite interesting because it's a type of mummy that is not very well known, like not as much as like Egyptian mummies, for example. But it's funny because I saw, I think it was a BBC video some time ago that explained the different types of mummies that occur depending on conditions. Okay. So it's like we're used to thinking of mummies in the way that the Egyptian ones look, but that's caused by dryness. These ones, of course, in the bog are caused by like damp.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I was going to say dampness, you would imagine, isn't a great preservative, but in this case...
But I think it's a combination of like the bacteria that lives in in the plants,
yeah.
Together with the dampness. And there are other, you know, mummies that like cause by salt, and there are a number of processes that cause mummies, and they give them different aspects. And I think the thing with the bog bodies is that they, whenever they're preserved, as you say, is very rare. But whenever they're preserved, they have like a very human aspect, a very real aspect. And one of the ones that has been very successful on Twitter, that was the Tolon man, that is a mummy that was found in Denmark in like the 1950s. It looks like a bronze statue, you know. Okay. The features really look like completely real. And
But Seamus Heaney used like this in his poetry, obviously. So why those poems? What was the point of discussing them or using them as a theme?
As a theme, I think what he's trying to do, he was definitely interested in different aspects of, I think it's of the human condition, really, which is one of his themes. But he's very attracted to these mummies because, I don't know, they seem to represent a distant past, because some of them are like from the Iron Age, so
yeah,
they're generally old, but still show like human characteristics. And I don't know, I think he wonders what happened to them and how they ended there. And so it's almost like a dialogue between what would have happened to the mummy and what the mummy like can actually say, and how he actually relates that to his environment and political situation, society, and so on.
So, okay, that's very interesting that he's using that, because we also went to an exhibition today near Banco de España, and again, concerned with the past, because these are photographs from the 1850s, 1860s, some from the 1920s from the same photographer, but primarily from the latter half of the 19th century. And he was quite a famous man who set up a Madrid photography shop in Calle San Jerónimo, which is not too far away from the city center. And do you remember his nombre, his name?
Well, they call him Juan Lauren, basically, because that's how they would have pronounced it in Spain. But, well, suppose he was Jean Laurent. Should be the proper way of calling him.
Yeah, it's amazing because the photographs are... it's hard to pin down what they are. He integrated himself, ingratiated himself into social circles. So he took pictures of the Queen, who was later dethroned and replaced by a democratic government. And he took pictures of famous people of the time. Also of Spanish peasants walking around. So kind of landscapes, panoramas, kind of famous people. Now, some of the photographs are interesting technically because they capture a great light. One in particular of sailors all just framed around in this kind of arc, and they're looking at their instruments, and it just has a light of a movie from the 1920s almost. It has that kind of that energy to it. Not technically, obviously, you know, we have to judge it by the standards of the time. Lowndes has portraits of important people, and the fact that he could manipulate his camera at this time when it was a new invention is noteworthy in itself. But there's not like a lot of photographs that really grab your attention either. Though there's a panorama of Madrid where it looks like a really small city compared to what it is today. Which reminds me, actually, I mentioned as well to you as well, we won't go into this in too much detail, but I read an article from National Geographic in the 1980s. It was written in 1988, which is like obviously 30 years ago, more or less. And yeah, actually, I say that we're not going to go too much into it, but I think we have a little bit of time before we go to part two. It's like the comparison of a foreigner, of two foreigners looking at Madrid, because you were impressed more or less that the photographer at this time was showing a modern Spain. Wasn't just pictures of I don't know what would be considered typically Spanish back then, which is what people would have expected and demanded as customers, but just showing a modernizing Spain with trains and the Museo de Ferrocarril, which is in the Lisias, which is a beautiful place. He was commissioned to chart the construction of that building as well. So in one sense, he was amazing because he kind of like was just showing a modern country, while the guy in the 80s, I presumably was American, also interviewed famous people, the Duque de Alba, the future king, I should say, and even like minor characters in terms of like just ordinary people on the street and everything. But he was still kind of talking about siestas and bullfights and all that crack. So I guess it's just kind of like, it's just a contrast now between, I mean, one guy from so long ago is a bit more progressive, and modern writers just seem to fall back on the same cliches when discussing Spain, no?
Yes, I would say so. We talked about that issue existing in the travel literature from like 1920s, 1930s, which was a very popular period for Americans and English people, for example, to come and travel around Spain and give an overview. I think in a way it's still the same problem today. I mean, we've just talked about the 1980s, but I think to a point, the sort of things, and you were mentioning the other day too, when you read blogs about, I was going to say expats, because probably it's the sort of people that would call themselves expats, living here, and then it's always, I don't know, I mean, of course there's always a bit of like truth in every cliche, in every stereotype for countries, but it just seems a bit lazy, I think, to just portray it in that way. So it was refreshing that at least this person, end of the 19th century, he was treating, I got the impression, at least Spain as an equal to his own country, which was France, which is, to be honest, quite surprising because it's not as if we're like historically best of friends. But yeah, I think that was like quite a nice thing. And there were some, I was missing more ethnography, you know. There were some people there, but most of them were, you know, upper class, and it was like portrayed, so it was staged. But still, there were a couple of ones that I think were the most striking ones, that were some peasants and then like a hermit.
A hermit, yeah, well, a hermit priest.
So
yeah,
that was really striking. That's actually striking.
That was an amazing photograph because it looked like a Bergman movie or something like that. It was just so dramatic, like this wandering preacher. It was a character you would be familiar with, but to see him in his actual setting and context was very, very striking. You're correct there. Well, I guess before we wrap up before part two, also as well is that, well, I mean, both of these things, like different mediums and a couple of hundred years apart, but really they're seeing or showing a city in tremendous flux. So at the photographer's time, Madrid is modernizing in terms of infrastructure, but in terms of Madrid in the 80s, it's also doing that, you know, building new things in Atocha, trying to improve the traffic, which is still an issue today, but also just transitioning from the era of Franco, experiencing La Movida, which we've done a podcast on as well, and just establishing itself socially and politically after many years of dictatorship as well. So anyway, we were supposed to talk about something else in part one. We'll move that gingerly to part two because we have spoken too much in part one. So we will join you momentarily after the musical interlude. Welcome to part two of the show. We have a full roster for this part. We'll be talking about an aristocrat, not a cat, tea drinker, juice smuggler. It's got off to an amazing start. Juice smuggler. We'll be talking about about World War II, Vladimir Lenin, World War I stuff there, and about Marquez, his book, No One Writes to the Colonel, and then Pio Baroja as well.
Good, well done you.
Wow, that is so much stuff to cover. We'll start off with Margaret Carney Taylor. We're supposed to cover her in part one. She was an amazing woman, As I will, we wrote an article about it on the blog. Mm-hmm. We'll plug that in the third part. I start off by saying that the hidden stories of history are usually the best ones, and this is certainly the case because this was virtually unknown until Embassy, which is the name of her cafeteria or tea shop, closed down a couple of years ago, and of course, in all the newspapers, published stories about its hidden past. You know, and the author Jimmy Burns, who's written books about Barcelona and is also a writer, a freelancer in the Spanish media. His father was a spy working for the British in Madrid at this time as well, and he would frequent Embassy, and he also told a lot of stories about it. But Margaret Carney Taylor is like an amazing person. She was born illegitimately, which is relevant to her story as well, because her mother presumably was also, but her daughter was also an illegitimate daughter, born from a union with a Spanish diplomat, and she fought for the paternity rights for her daughter at a time when, you know, you didn't see many single mothers or illegitimate children, and she won the case, which kind of gave a bit of a hint to her personality and her character. Now, why she's relevant is because, well, she was dirt poor when she was born, and she kind of fought her way up to the very high elements of high class society. Sorry, it's the time of the podcast again where I can't breathe. And also, those contacts would serve her very well during the Second World War in Madrid. She did leave the city during the Spanish Civil War, but came back for the Second World War. And it was through Embassy, as I said, her tea shop. And Mary, you already know this story, but thank you for listening so attentively. It was a point through which Allied servicemen and Jewish people would be taken out of Spain and to safety to places like the UK, and out of the hands and grips of people like the Nazis. An incredible story, because she was known as a socialite, you know, through great parties, introduced cocktails in the evening hour, which was a big thing back then, like a new fashion trend imported from France. And even when she died, like back in 1982, you know, I mean, nobody knew about this side of her life. And it was only recently when people discovered documents that kind of shed more light on her activities for the British Secret Service during the Second World War in her tea shop, Embassy. And her friends, who are still alive, could not believe it, because she was a genteel woman who was a society lady, but she was very instrumental in saving roughly 30,000 lives, you know, helping 30,000 people escape from Madrid by forging passports, by springing people from a concentration camp near Madrid with false documents, and then they'd be hidden in her apartment or in the embassy. And the German embassy, an actual embassy, not a tea shop, was just up the road, which had literally 1,000 spies on its payroll as well. So she became friends with a fascist, phalangist, who was Franco's brother-in-law and also a devotee of Heinrich Himmler. You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's his name?
Serrano Junior.
Exactly. And her friendship with him kind of protected the embassy from being raided by the Nazis, because even if they had, like, maybe a suspicion, because she was friendly with this guy who was high up in Franco's power structure, that gave her a lot of protection as well. So it is an amazing story that needs to be told kind of widespread. Because I even told you before the podcast about a Spanish spy called Garbo, who a lot of people don't know, who helped the British and gave false information to the Nazis, particularly around D-Day as well. There's the Angel of Budapest, who's a Spanish diplomat in Hungary. Now, Hungary was also anti-Semitic, arguably more anti-Semitic than Nazi Germany even. He saved, I think, 5,000 Jews there. And there's like an Irish priest in the Vatican who also did the same, helped Allied servicemen and Jews escape from the Vatican into safe lands, for example. So we will be talking about World War II in a little bit in more detail, but it's just amazing how this history of World War II, you have these individuals whose stories are not really well known, but who took great personal risks and displayed great personal courage to save, more than countless lives, you know, like a lot of lives. It's just a breathtaking story, and we were there on Monday to the place in the Castellana. Unfortunately, it's closed now, but did you get a sense of the history when we were there? Was there something in the atmosphere?
Well, I think it's a district that still has a lot of history. There's still a lot of embassies around, and if you've read up a little bit about the things that were going on in Madrid, then I think you can kind of like grasp that atmosphere from, not necessarily from the cafe itself, but just in the area.
Yeah, well, opposite, on the other side of the street, there is the Korean Cultural Center. So, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, as you mentioned, I know, like, where am I going with this? But as you mentioned, that it has a lot of embassies and just has, like an international vibe. And it just, you know, it's interesting to hear about it as well because, like, the Castellana, is it on Alcala or Castellana?
It's Castellana. In Castellana, yeah. Yes.
Which is
a very, the very beginning.
It's a very long street as well, like Alcala. That's why I was getting confused. But, you know, Castellana today isn't like the most amazing street. Like, it's expensive. You have lots of businesses there and all that kind of stuff. But for me, it's kind of hard to imagine the kind of glamorous socialites going there, you know, like it being Goya or Serrano today. But obviously back then it had more of that pinta, you know, that more of that look, you know?
Yeah, it's also kind of like the back of, even if it's in Castellana, it's kind of like the back of Serrano and the back of,
yes,
of that
course.
Neighborhood. So in a way, it's like kind of the farthest edge. So I suppose it was close enough, the poorest areas that you're talking about, for it to be within that realm, but also close to more embassies and so on.
Well, okay. Well, I think we've taken this part as far as we can, but we'll say one more thing. Jimmy Byrne said informally he was speaking to someone from maybe Pepe, I don't know, and he was like saying that, like, where the cafe is now should be a museum because it's closed. You can find three other shops around the city, but they're nothing to really write home about in terms of, I mean, they have the name, but
yeah,
nothing happened
seems.
There but like nothing's happened on the front of making it a museum. But the Irish Embassy in 2018, so like last December, honored her on International Human Rights Day, and it was just very fitting that you know, all these years later, you know, there's a recognition of the great work that she did as well. So anything else you want to say about Taylor?
No, I think that's a wrap. Well, in the article we go into a bit more detail about the things that we've talked about. So
yeah, exactly. Blog post. yeah, so check out our blog post on irishslicemadrid, wordpress.com. Link in the description. So we have Marcus, World War II, to talk about Lenin and old Pio there as well. Will we go to World War II first?
Okay.
Just to keep the thematic link.
Yeah, you can tell me more about that because I haven't read this book, but you have.
So. Excuse me for coughing and not using the cough button. We'll get there eventually.
That we never use.
Yeah, just when I was like back for Christmas, I just picked up this book I read years ago by Lawrence Rees called Their Darkest Hour. The Financial Times calls it chilling and important read. And the Daily Mail calls it fascinating but disturbing. And yes, I am reading that from the front cover as we speak. Anthony Beaver calls it. Okay, I'll stop. But it's again, you know, not only is it thematically with the World War II, but focusing on individual stories. And actually, I just realized how we can segue into Gabriel Garcia Marquez after this as well. So this is all tying together beautifully, even though disparate links. Anyway, so you have it's just people in a variety of contexts. The book is divided into resistance fighters, people involved in genocide, people who helped the regime, people who are prisoners, and people who are part, like, of, as I said, genocide, mass killings, and in soldiers of belief, and in people like who performed mass suicide. Well, of course, the people he speaks to manage to avoid that. But he ends the book kind of talking about how, despite how deeply held our beliefs can be, they can change very easily with circumstance and with survival in mind. So even though great things can happen and great movements of people, great ideologies, well, great in terms of size, not, you know, in any positive sense, but things like fascism and communism can be swiftly abandoned when they're not expedient anymore to believe in them, when the prevailing society around it has been erased and it's better to be something else, another type of ism or whatever, you know. So like that kind of malleability of humans, just like, which is good in some respects or some contexts, but also negative, that, you know, terrible things can be discarded when it's not convenient anymore and people can kind of move on. Now, there's interesting examples of that, because you have a woman who was Swedish who acted for Hitler, and, you know, she says afterwards, like, that she tried to read about the Nazis and all the evil things they did, but it's just very impossible because Hitler was always very nice to her, and he had wonderful blue eyes. So, and then, like, you know, exactly, but there's also, like, people in there who just remember how fun Nazi Germany was before the war, and even in the early parts of the war, I imagine, as well, because they're winning all around them, so they aren't really feeling the pinch of a war that turned against them. And just how things like the rounding up of the Jews was really swept under the carpet. It's like, well, that was unfortunate, of course, I didn't support that, but, you know, the parties were amazing, you know. So also how, like the dichotomy and just how easy it is for people to just not think about things. I mean, again, with the Nazis, I mean, he talks about Japanese people, some amazing things about kamikaze pilots, the interview there, that guy was amazing. With Americans as well, with British people, like a British guy who helped kind of betray the Yugoslavians, the American guy who was on the crew of the plane that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. Again, he was a very nice man, apparently, but he didn't lose any sleep. He's like, because I didn't see it, because I was in the plane, it was like a video game. It didn't matter. It was distant. I it just doesn't bother me. I don't have nightmares about it.
But also he really believed in the need to do it, I think.
Exactly. He felt like if this is what takes to end the war, then I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. And then there's a guy who was like working in Auschwitz. And like Auschwitz, obviously we know as the concentration camp, but close to it as well was kind of like a little town almost with gossiping and theater shows and dinners and everything, and again for a lot of people it was tremendously fun. And like he saw one day an SS guard beat the crap out of a Jewish prisoner, and he was like, this cannot happen, you know. So it's just like if he came across an instant of obvious brutality, he was appalled, but then when he knew like that what was happening with the extermination, he just kind of accepted it because it was out of sight, out of mind. And he even said, like, look, if you thought about it, you'd go mad, so I just didn't think about it. So it's like flicking a switch very, very easily. What was I going to say about this man as well? He obviously at the time felt that it was necessary to do that. But even the prevailing kind of attitude at the time was like that, well, if the Americans and the British are dropping bombs on Dresden and firebombing, you know, their cities, which is a questionable part of the war as well, they felt, well, us exterminating the Jews is on a par with that, so we're all doing bad things, therefore we're not really doing a bad thing, kind of thing. So it's just amazing. I mean, there's a story of a boy who was like blonde, taken from his Polish mother, grew up a Nazi, given to a German family, grew up hating the Poles, and then, you know, he falls out with it, like his mother dies, his German mother, his Polish mother, his real mother, comes back in contact with him. And then he doesn't really want to, he doesn't care, he's like, I'm German, just go away. But then he fights with his father because he remarries, doesn't like the stepmother, so to kind of like F off to him, he goes to Poland, becomes a Polish citizen without even realizing the consequences of that, because by this time the Iron Curtain has fallen down, because it's after the Second World War, he can't leave until communism has fallen, and he misses the funeral of his father, his German father, like his, you know, his adopted father and his adopted German grandfather as well. So you know, amazing stuff, like the kamikaze things, as bizarre as that sounds, you know, like it shows like the rationale of how like, you know, it's not that crazy. I mean, they just knew they had to do it, because if they didn't, they'd be punished or sent to a battle where they would definitely die as well. So because of the climate, they knew, like, there's no option in this, we have to do it. You know, even mothers telling their sons before they go to war, just like, don't come back alive, if you get captured, kill yourself and everything as well. So amazing things. Very few stories of redemption, to be fair. It is quite a dark book. So I don't know. I mean, I've been talking a lot about it, but I guess it's very shocking for you to hear these stories as well.
Well, it makes me want to read it, so I'll be borrowing this one. Thank you very much.
Well, you can take it today. So, exactly. So the reason I say as well that, excuse me, I'm going to cough again. Cough button. Okay, great. That worked. Okay, so the reason this is going to segue into Marquez, this is, you forgot what book I was reading with Marquez.
Marquez. Yeah. Agore Modelop. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought you were reading...
Chronicles of a Dead Foretold.
That's it. But you were reading...
what was I reading? No One Writes to the Colonel.
Yes.
Well, the idea is like... because like in the book, Lawrence Reese's book, Their Darkest Hour, like there's a chapter with a guy also who was like a true believer, a Belgian guy, I think, who really hated like communists and really loved Hitler. And his whole deal was like he like fought like a lion and he got injured because he was just such a brave fighter. You know, objectively, again, I'm not like praising him or anything, but he survived the war, and then he was interviewed like in his home, like a very nice home apparently, according to the writer. And he just spent his time kind of like in a very banal, humdrum way, just like staying around the house, watching TV, and particularly watching like movies about World War II to kind of see the lies of the Allies, you know, they're telling the history wrong. But the reason this is kind of segues into Marquez is because this is about a colonel and his wife who basically have been eking out an existence because they lost, he was on the losing side of the Civil War, and kind of goes into the... again, almost the banality of, as I said, like, you know, you lose the war and you lose the peace because, like, you don't get like a chance to have a stake in society. You're dependent on money from a government that keeps changing, and that's not on your side. We see that in Lawrence Reese's books as well. If you were even a Soviet, you know, who got imprisoned by the Nazis, like a real victim, you're treated with suspicion when you come back to Soviet Union, and you know you work, but you're paid less and you're treated very differently. So it's just like examining the life of someone who's lost the war in this novel and what that actually means. Like, what are the long-term consequences of that? We don't really see that very often. You know, you don't see that in movies very often. And that's kind of the story in a nutshell. You have read this as well. And I remember you thinking, well, it's a good story, but it's not like amazing or fantastic or anything like that, no?
No, I thought it was okay, but... he's got other ones that I found a lot more striking. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else you want to say?
No.
Okay.
You need to tell us about the next book.
No. We probably won't get to the PO one, but we can talk about Lenin in just a moment, so you can say something. I just think it's a great book because it shows Marquez's one, because it shows how dignity goes out the window when you're poor, you're feeding on scraps. It's like it's a fight for dignity, and there's never really a clear option on how you can get out of that situation. And no matter what you choose, you're still compromising your dignity a little bit, and it's never really a full victory as well. So it's like a compromise with a compromise. And even when you do have that realization, as the colonel has at the end of the book, you know, it's not really full or resolute because it's grounded in a feeling. But you know, he could also say other things or do other things, and it might offer him the same amount of redemption, or maybe a little bit less, a little bit more, but ultimately there's no true way out for him. Anyway, that's kind of like the book in a nutshell. I could go on for longer, but I won't, because we are 19 minutes into part two, and I want to hear your thoughts on a book you did borrow from me a while ago, which is called Lenin on a Train by a girl called Catherine Merridale, I think, or... she's a great Russian... well, she writes about Russian history. She wrote a book about Russian soldiers as well, called Ivan, or something like that. And anyway, Lenin, you liked the book. It was a long read, but you liked it.
It was okay. It was very factual. I think the title is a bit misleading because, well, it's called Lenin on a Train. It's supposed to be about the trip that that he has. And it is, but, you know, in between... there are huge chapters kind of like detailing everything that is going on politically in all the different groups, and it can get a little bit heavy going. I think perhaps that device of the train could have been exploited further. I think, I mean, I certainly wouldn't call it funny, like Simon Bagmont Montefiore says on the cover. Yeah, I didn't find it particularly funny. But no, it's got some interesting aspects. You know, I think I almost found more interesting all the part that deals with Lenin living in Switzerland and in Zurich and like being there before everything kicks off in Russia, you know. So because, well, it gives you an idea of basically what he was doing and what he kept himself busy with, which was reading like crazy and writing and just analyzing things and coming up with theories and all that. While then the actual trip itself, well, it's got some bits and pieces, but I was expecting it to be a far bigger device for the book than it actually was.
Well, also as well, it features fascinating characters like Rasputin and how they the plot to assassinate him is also very interesting. It dovetails nicely with how we started part two as well with espionage, because this is really also kind of like the beast story in this book is the birth of European and particularly British espionage, because this is the early days of MI6 and how a lot of the time they didn't really know what they were doing, and also secondly how Russia became a country like Madrid in the Second World War, like an open country. Moscow was like an open city in a way, like Madrid was, and it's just full of journalists and spies and people from both sides of various persuasions and various objectives and like a lot of them unsavory as well. And that's like, I guess, a compelling component of the book as well, the birth of something that we take for granted nowadays. But also to see this international fulcrum, which was this country, and in a way, in a very modern way, you know, America and Britain are waiting for the economic opportunities after the war. They're trying to set up Russia for exploitation financially, while the Germans, of course, are trying to exploit it to stay in the war and tire out the Allies, or the British and the Americans in World War One as well. So just how it became the plaything of different superpowers and the real politic behind that as well. I don't know. I mean, obviously, there's always parallels with the modern times as well. Is that something that you found enjoyable or interesting when you were reading it?
Yes, it's striking, isn't it? How countries that are apparent enemies, then they help each other against a common enemy, or also like all the deals, like back deals and everything that is going on, kind of like, backstage, to convince people, and how, I don't know, somebody who's regarded as like an enemy number one, then if it's convenient, can become kind of like a pawn to.
Yeah. Well, that's it, because like it's a huge what if part of European, well, world history, because everybody knew Lenin was going back from exile to Russia to strike while the iron was hot at this particular moment in time. And yeah, as you mentioned, like the British and possibly the French didn't want him to go back, but the Germans gave him safe passage and he was allowed to go in his train, to get to Russia basically. And if he had been stopped, it'd be a whole different ballpark probably, you know. I mean, the revolution was still happening anyway, and other characters probably would have come to the fore, but he was very important at this time as well, so I don't know, it's just what would have happened, nobody knows, but it is a tantalizing question as well.
Yes, definitely. I think that's probably one of the most striking things about the book and the most meaningful thing, I think, about focusing on the actual train. You know, because you're thinking, well, it's a very long journey, a lot of things are happening while he's traveling, and I think that's probably the only reason why that aspect of the whole thing is relevant, isn't it? Because it just kind of like provides the timeline to be able to explain everything that goes on in between and all the deals that you're talking about, and how, you know, politics change and adapt to whatever is convenient for each country. So
also, as a side note, and this is the last thing we can say about it maybe, but it's fascinating how the writer also was in the USSR in her university days, and how there's a There's a few intellectuals who are probably secretly in love with Russia's past, and I guess would be Western skeptic, even though they're Western. I don't know if that's fair to say about that particular order, but in general, there's probably a few Russian writers out there who are I guess very pro-Russian, no?
Yeah, well, I think at the beginning she sort of like defends himself from, because she points out how Lenin is now completely not popular at all in Russia even.
Yeah.
Or especially in Russia, in fact. So she just kind of like defends herself that she's not trying to... I think in reality, probably it's more the whole kind of like nostalgia about the whole... communism era, probably, or also, I don't know, I think that there is a romantic element to the trip that he takes, and it's all like very epic in terms of like him kind of like almost going as a savior, yeah. Even though in the book it speaks about how some people didn't like wanting to go back at all, and
yeah,
you know, some of the his own people turn against him and stuff. So
okay, well, Lenin on the Train is a book that you should read. Also, No One Writes to the Colonel by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Lawrence Reese's A Their Darkest Hour. And also a blog article on Margaret Carney Taylor, so the Irish woman who saved Jews during World War II, and also Allied servicemen. So that is it for part two. So please do join us for part three after this musical interlude. Alright, you melon head. We're back in part three. I never knew that was a Spanish insult as well. To call someone a melon.
Well, it's a very mild one.
Yeah, that was a very American thing.
But effective.
Jonathan from Gibraltar, actually, he's called me a melon before as well.
Well, there you go. Maybe you did something to deserve it both times.
Maybe I did. I'm so much of a melon, I can't remember the things we have to plug now. So this is where you step in, Mary.
Radio Public.
Okay, what happens with Radio Public? Yes. I'm intrigued.
Please listen to us on Radio Public. Because if you do...
Yeah?
Yes?
No, I was going to say, we could do one of those, like, commercials where I pretend I don't know what this product is for. And you're like, you know, explain it to me. I'm like, are you sure it cuts carrots and also does my taxes for me?
No. Okay. So this is not the case.
Radio Public.
All it does is that... well, we get some money whenever you listen through there. And recently, we haven't done very well, so get on listening on Radio Public.
Well, no, let's
stop listening on Spotify.
Let's clarify. We are getting a lot of listens, as per usual, right? Just let's not, like, spread fake news here. It's unfortunately, it's not true, a paid program. So either you're too lazy to listen to this on the preferred podcast player, or you don't care about our welfare. And we have to, I mean, we had tea today. We had to, like, reuse tea bags 10 times just to get, you know, anyway, enough of our tale of woe. So you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, Patreon as well. Also, the blog is Irish Slice of Madrid. For now, it's .wordpress.com. But if you just, we'll put a link to one of our articles, the one we mentioned in part two, in the description of the podcast as well. So you'll be able to click on that directly. And yeah. Apart from that, we'll be back next week with another amazing installment of the Elaborate Podcast. And for now, this is ciao, ciao.
Bye.
The Elaborate Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.